Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. I'm Grant Reher. The midterm elections produced a record number of women in Congress, and almost half of the declared presidential candidates are women. How significant are these developments, and what differences can we expect them to make? My guest today is Susan Carroll. She's a political science and women's studies professor at Rutgers University and a senior scholar at Rutgers' Center for American Women and Politics. Her most recent book is A Seat at the Table, Congresswomen's Perspectives on Why Their Presence Matters. Professor Carroll, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Pleased to be here.
Well, you couldn't have been more timely with your more recent book. That's for sure.
I know. We did time that pretty well. Accidentally, but.
Well, there's always a place for serendipity.
Serendipity, yes.
So let me start with this. President Trump likes to take credit for things. Are the record numbers of women in Congress and the record numbers of women running for president something that, you know, we can, in a sense, thank him for?
Well, that's an interesting way to look at it. But I guess the answer really is kind of yes. Uh-huh. I think we saw in the aftermath of the election of Donald Trump to the presidency, we saw the Women's March. We've seen the Me Too movement. We've seen a lot of activism by women, not only in terms of women running for office, but in other kinds of ways. So he did, in fact, generate a lot of interest on the part of Democratic women to run for office. And in fact, this year was a year for Democratic women much more so than for Republican women. Mm. I mean, Republican women in the House of Representatives actually went backwards in terms of numbers, whereas the Democrats went way up. And so there were really so it really brought women to the forefront who, many of them had otherwise might not have thought about running for office, but they were just so appalled either by his policy positions or by the behavior he was seeing, and some of them by the fact that they had expected Hillary Clinton to run or to win, and she did not, and they were disappointed at that, and they just realized it was time to take the bull by the horn, so to speak.
And I want to break that record surge down into different components here, but as a way to start to do that, you mentioned the Republican losses for women in Congress, or was that located in the House primarily or the Senate?
That was located in the House. They actually picked up one person. Numerically one woman in the House. And then, of course, they actually now have two additional women because Martha McSally was appointed to take John McCain's seat.
Okay. In the Senate. Okay.
In the House. So the gains were really located in the House for the Democrats.
Okay. So with the Republican losses, and maybe we can just talk about this more generally in the House, where's the dynamic there? Maybe let's think about it in terms of the women who are winning. Where's the dynamic there? Is it did you see an overall surge in terms of candidate emergence, people coming forward, and women being recruited? The parties thinking, hey, this would be a good year for women. And then was there a difference in the willingness to run to say, yes, I'll answer the call? And then was there a difference in actually winning? I mean, there's all these different pieces in the pipeline of actually getting to office. And so where in that, or maybe it was all the way through, that we saw these surges in women numbers?
I think it was all the way through. I mean, I do think it was there definitely were record numbers of women running for office, not just at the congressional level, but at the state legislative level as well. We saw women and probably at the local level, although we don't have good data on that. But there were, women seemed to be running in record numbers all over the country, all different levels of office. We don't know for sure how much of that involved recruitment by parties, by the political party, because it really would be the Democratic Party. Although I think the Democratic Party did recognize once these women started coming forward that there was something going on and that they had a lot of support and that it was a good moment for women to be running. So they entered primaries in record numbers. They won primaries in record numbers. Mm-hmm. And then they obviously won the general election in record numbers as well.
So you mentioned the different factors that contributed to this, the expectation that Hillary Clinton would win and the political effects of that collective disappointment, the reaction to President Trump. Were there other things that don't get talked about as much that might be components of why we saw so many women running and winning?
Well, there are a lot of long-term factors that have been in the works for a while. Like, there's a lot of, or a fair amount of candidate training and, you know, and trying to, like, identify women and bring women to come forward. We actually run a program out of the Center for American Women in Politics called Ready to Run, which started in New Jersey, but we've now sort of found partners in in various states across the country. So it is a candidate training program. You know, it's a program to try to get women who are interested in politics to build some skills, to provide them with some role models, to give them concrete information that they need to run for office. So those things have been in place now for a while. So that's part of it too, and there's an infrastructure for women candidates now. Emily's List is the most is the most highly visible, recognized part of that infrastructure, which is,
and that
you
goes
know,
back to the '70s, doesn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, yeah. But you know, but they've basically equalized the playing field for women running at the congressional level by providing resources that women otherwise wouldn't have. And it's not just money, because it is money, but it's also a network. Connecting them to technical expertise. So for women running to Congress, there is this equalizer, and there has been for a while. And then there also are PACs, political action committees, similar ones, small ones at the state level throughout several states, not every state, but many states. So there's an infrastructure now to support women running for office. So there are long-term factors that were at play, and there are short-term factors that were at play.
And those long-term factors lead to another question I wanted to ask you about this, which is, all right, so we had this moment in 2018. Do you think this is kind of an outlier blip on the radar screen, or do you think this is a more permanent inflection point for women in politics in the United States?
Well, that's the $64,000 question if ever I heard one. We don't know yet. It's too soon. It's too soon to tell. I mean, I'm optimistic that we're really in the midst of a sea change, you know, and that this is going to continue, that we're at a new normal, not necessarily that we will see the kinds of gains that we saw in this election, in upcoming elections, but that the normal has gone up, that the baseline's gone up, and that we will be able to maintain these gains and build on them. So that I feel fairly confident about. It's going to be 10 years out before we know whether this is something permanent or some sort of, one-time, one-off event.
I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Rutgers University professor Susan Carroll. So going back to the process of running for office, and you spoke to this earlier in talking about Emily's List and the networks and how those things have changed long term. But once women come forward as candidates or want to be potential candidates, still today, what particular disadvantages do they have in trying to win? Is it a level playing field, or what still remains there that might stand in their way?
Well, I don't think it is a completely level playing field. In fact, one of the interesting things that came out, I know we're going to talk about this in a little while, but, this book on...
We're going to get to your book. Yeah, yeah.
But one of the things we ask of women in Congress when we interviewed women who were serving, and this was the 114th Congress, was about the challenges they faced in the institution. And what surprised us, and this was actually probably the most surprising finding to us in the book, or certainly one of the most surprising, was that they said they had the challenges were greater getting there than, and we didn't even ask about the challenges getting there, that the challenges getting there were much greater than the challenges being there.
Interesting.
So they think challenges still remain in terms of campaigning for office.
Fundraising
is a piece of it. Yeah. Not necessarily once they're general election candidates on the Democratic side, because you've got Emily's List, although the Republican infrastructure for women is much, much weaker. So the Republican women don't have that strong a support system in terms of resources. But But primaries are a problem. Getting support through primaries and getting people – it's the early – I think getting people to believe in you early is like before they are sure that you're a viable candidate is a problem area for women. And raising early money in those primaries, because generally speaking Emily List does get involved somewhat in primaries, I think. But for the most part, a lot of the women in primaries don't have, they just don't have a basis of financial support. So they have to rely on their own resources, and it's a little bit harder.
So I want to get into your book now and draw on that and also the other research that's been done in this area that you are an expert on, and explore what differences it makes having more women in elected positions. What's the evidence on this? And certainly from the standpoint of democratic legitimacy, I think it's obvious that having more women in elected office is important. But, beyond that, do women tend to behave differently as political representatives in important ways? What are the differences?
Well, I can tell you what they told us, because we did talk to women in Congress, and what they told us is that they bring different life experiences, and that gives them different perspectives, and that they're perspectives that need to be represented at the table when decisions are being made. So they'll talk about, particularly a lot of them talk about being moms or being caregivers, women's roles as caregivers, and that gives them different perspectives. They'll talk about how, well, we're all different. We all have different perspectives, but we share these experiences of being caregivers, that seems to be a commonality, and they feel that gives them a different way of thinking, not only in terms of things that we think of as women's issues, but, other kinds of policies as well. So they see themselves as bringing different perspectives to bear because of their experiences, and also they're even workforce that women are in different kinds of occupations a lot. They're more likely to be teachers, they're more likely to be nurses and healthcare professionals. So they bring those perspectives to bear as well. So there's a variety. I mean, it's not just the caregiver. The family role, but also experiences outside of the family that they bring to bear, and it's both in terms of agenda setting, in terms of bringing new issues to the table that otherwise might not have been seen, which of course is what the feminist movement has been about. For several years, like violence against women didn't used to be an issue. Domestic violence didn't used to be an issue. Women's health didn't used to be an issue. And the women in Congress have played critical roles over the years on all those issues. But it's also when they're debating, things we might not think of as gendered issues, but they'll think about the impact on families and children. They say they're more likely to than the men who are sitting at the table.
So it's both different kinds of policy issues, but then also different ways of seeing policy issues. Yes. You're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm talking with Rutgers University professor Susan Carroll, and we're discussing women in elected office. Her recent book is titled A Seat at the Table: Congresswomen's Perspectives on Why Their Presence Matters. So you talked about the policy differences that might, some of the agenda setting differences that might be as a result of having more women in elected positions, and then also the perspectives they bring on many or most policy issues. Is it fair to say that when you add that all up, one of the differences is that women are more liberal than men, or is that not fair to say?
Well, I don't know that it's fair to say that women are more liberal than men, because I think they span the ideological spectrum. It depends on how you define liberal. If you define being concerned about family issues and social policy as liberal, then perhaps. But you have to realize that the Republican women who are in Congress are uniformly, I think, or at least almost uniformly, but pretty much uniformly, as is the Republican Party, pro-life. That's generally not seen as a liberal policy position by any stretch of the imagination. So they will bring, for example, they'll talk about, they'll see it as having to do with their – they'll talk about abortion and they'll see it as having to do with their roles and their, you know, bringing their experiences as women. Mm. But they bring, you know, but they're, where they end up on the issue is very different from where the progressive Democratic women end up on the issue. So the same life experience can result in very different perspectives for women. They still bring their perspectives, but they can result in different kinds of political positioning.
So let's think about the way that, that women approach leadership roles and their styles mm-hmm. as leaders mm-hmm. within the chamber, maybe committee chair, you know, speaker mm-hmm. or whatever. Is there evidence that they engage in those behaviors differently, that they approach leadership differently than men?
Well, one of the things we did explore in our research and was, you know, how if they saw themselves as going about their business differently, their okay. legislative business. And they told us uniformly we heard over and over and over again that they were motivated differently than men, that men are more likely to be motivated by personal ambition, that the women are more results oriented, that the women are there not to be somebody but to make, you know, to bring about change, to bring about policy, because of policy issues that they care about. So they talked about how women are problem solvers. They really see themselves as problem solvers. They've come to Congress to solve problems, not necessarily to advance their own personal ambition. Of course, they are ambitious. We've got five women from Congress running for president. So it's not that they don't have personal ambition, but that's not what motivates them primarily, as they see it.
Does that make them more collaborative, do you think, and inclusive in the way that they go about these things?
That's the other point I was going to make.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's good. You anticipated it. they do say that. They tend to think that they're that they are more collaborative in their style, that they want to include more people, that they're more likely to seek consensus. Now, an interesting question is, does that mean they're more bipartisan?
Yes.
And we asked that of them as well. And some of them said no, you know, that men and women are equally bipartisan. But a majority said they thought the women were more bipartisan and more likely to try to reach across the aisle and try to work with people who didn't agree with them, again, because they see themselves as problem solvers.
So are there differences in the way that they deal with their constituents? I mean, one thing that occurs to me, an issue here in this area, for example, with previous members and a current member is how often they hold town meetings, you know, and so a woman challenger to our incumbent member of Congress said, I'm going to hold tons of town meetings, you know. So is there any evidence that they're different in the way that they deal with their constituents?
I don't know that there's evidence that they're different, but I can tell you from talking with them that they're very responsive to their constituents. Mm. But so I think if you talk to male members of Congress, they're very responsive as well. I think part of being a member of Congress is that you better be responsive to your constituents or you're not going to be there very long, probably. So, but they definitely give examples of where constituents have come to see them and brought issues to their attention, and they've moved them forward. So it's not just constituent service in the sense of, solving individual problems, but really sometimes it leads to legislation for them, that they become aware of something they need to do. So they definitely see themselves as very constituent oriented. I don't have good data for the men, so I can't really tell you if the men see themselves as less constituency oriented.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to The Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. And my guest is Rutgers University professor Susan Carroll. So this is an age-old debate in social science, but I wanted to get your take on it. Do you expect that some of the differences that you're talking about might fade a bit if women go on to have more complete parity in elected positions? Because there was this surge, but there's still a distinct minority in the state legislatures and in Congress. So in other words, mm-hmm. are some of these differences in style and policy forged out of the experience of having less power, being disadvantaged, or are they baked in differences based on sex? is it possible to distinguish those? And where do you come down on that?
Well, you can't completely distinguish that, but I think they would say, and I guess I would agree with them, that that we sort of hope the differences go away over time as women get parity because the institution changes. In other words, that they will bring their, you know, that their different perspectives, their different styles will help to change the institution itself and change the behavior. And there is evidence that men's behavior has changed somewhat. I mean, just in that most superficial way, their decorum's a little better.
Rhetoric has changed.
Rhetoric somewhat, yeah. From the presence of women. And also that they're more attentive, the women, in their constituencies now. And they've discovered that women's issues are, you know, some of these issues are very popular with their constituents and can help them win votes. So men's behavior does change in response to having more women colleagues. You know, that's pretty clear, at least anecdotally, even if we don't have, like, good, hard data on it. You know, so I think these women would say, you know, their hope is definitely that they will change the institution. The institution will change with them, not so much that they will change totally to fit the institution.
So we've got a few minutes left, and I wanted to take some time and look at the presidential candidate pool so far, and particularly in terms of gender. And there's a record number of women. Is there anything about that group or anything about that dynamic so far of the emergence of candidates for president that is standing out to you in this issue of women in politics?
Well, what's standing out is that there are a lot of them. Mm. I mean, relative to what there's been before. I mean, we've been lucky to have one or two women running for the presidency, you know, across both parties even. And so, you know, so this is just totally unprecedented. But I think the most interesting thing about having all these women run is that the kind of stereotyping that happened, I think, with Hillary Clinton and, you know, also with, you know, other women who have run historically is less likely to happen this time because these women are different and there are many of them. So, you know, you can hardly stereotype, it's not going to be possible to talk about the woman candidate in the race. They're breaking down the notion that there is one way for a woman to run or that there's one style. I think we're going to see, you know, we're already seeing that with Amy Klobuchar taking a more heartland, moderate approach, and Elizabeth Warren, for example, taking a more progressive, you know, far more sort of, you know, leaning towards what people might call the socialist end of the spectrum approach, and they're talking about different kinds of issues. So there's not going to be one way to run as president, as a woman running for president anymore. I mean, that's for sure after this election.
Well, taking that point then, that, you know, they're different and it's going to be impossible or much harder to stereotype a woman candidate for president. Are we now, do you think, at a point where it's just simply a matter of time having the right candidate to have a woman as president? Or do you think there is still something out there that needs to be overcome before we will finally get a woman in the Oval Office?
Well, I think there's something out there that needs to be overcome, but I think we're very close to the time, and I'm hoping it occurs in the next election cycle or two. I think the fact that there are this many women coming forward and running is a big first step. I think Hillary Clinton broke down huge barriers for women. The very fact that we had our first major party nominee, that was a very important first step. And even though she, you know, didn't quite get over the finish line, in terms of electoral votes at least, nevertheless, you know, she was a pathbreaker, and she really did break down barriers. And these women are going to do the same thing, even if none of these women who are running this year emerge as the ultimate Democratic candidate, or even if none of them is elected president in 2020. Nevertheless, you know, the very fact that they're all running is like the next big step. So we're getting, with each successive election, I think we're getting a little closer. And maybe it'll happen this time.
One of the things I thought about Hillary Clinton's candidacy that goes to your point that you're just making is the importance of the fact that people thought she was going to win. I mean, you know, the country was sort of expecting that.
Right.
And that she was ahead in the polls for so much of the time. It would have been a different phenomenon, I think, for the kind of things you're talking about if she had been the nominee, but she was always running 10, 15 points back. I mean, we went through a period where people thought we are going to have a woman president.
Right.
And in fact, election night was a big surprise, I think, for the president himself. So,
Yeah, I think people got used to the idea.
Yes, exactly.
You know, it even if they didn't support Hillary Clinton, they thought she was going to win, and they became used to the idea that we could have a woman as president. So, I think it's very possible that it's going to happen soon.
Is among the candidates that are there now, you mentioned a few of them, is there any one of them that you think, all right, this is the right recipe?
I'm not going to reveal that. I think they're different recipes, and I'm not sure which one's the right one for the country at this moment.
Okay.
You know, and I think most of the pundits that you hear are saying the same kind of things that, you know, they're not sure. That's what this Democratic nomination is about, I think, is trying to sort out, you know, what recipe makes the most sense for the country right now. And they're offering very different alternatives, I think.
So I'm going to switch gears entirely. We only have about a minute or so left,
okay.
So I'm going to throw something else out at you. The Equal Rights Amendment.
Mm.
It's currently sitting one state ratification short of having the three-quarters threshold it needs for adoption. There's some controversy over the time limit that Congress put in the proposing clause of this, but just set that aside. Do you think, in a minute or so, that the Equal Rights Amendment will be ratified by the final state? And if it is, will that amendment make a difference, or have we kind of legislatively already encapsulated and gone beyond that? Where are we?
Wow, that's a tough one.
Sorry, 30 seconds.
That's a very tough question. I think the Equal Rights Amendment is still important for symbolic reasons, even if we have achieved. I think we'll make some difference in the law, small differences, but we have achieved a lot of the things that that would have been brought about by the Equal Rights Amendment. But sooner or later, we're going to get to the 38th state, and then we're going to see if the courts will, how the courts rule on whether this counts as ratification or not. But symbolically, I think it's still an important addition.
That was Susan Carroll. Susan, I want to thank you for taking the time to talk with me.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.
You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media, conversations in the public interest.
The Campbell Conversations, Conversations in the Public Interest, was hosted and produced by Grant Reher, engineered by Tom Fazio, and edited by Jason Smith. Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University and WRVO Public Media. To learn more about the program or to hear previous interviews, visit wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations.